There are many parents around the country who have probably developed a new appreciation for the teaching profession thanks to the COVID pandemic and the joys of homeschooling. Someone who knows it so well is our guest, Tim Heath. He spent 47 years as a teacher and principal in a number of schools around the country, from those in Auckland's inner city to small schools in the rural back blocks of New Zealand. He also taught for a time in Samoa and spent many years as an educational gypsy for the Correspondence School. Tim has taken his experience of teaching, the ideals, the mistakes, the joys and frustrations, and turned it into a funny and compelling read in his new book, The Accidental Teacher. He is with us from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, Lev 3. Kia ora, Tim. Welcome.
Yeah, kia ora, Catherine. Good to be here. Good.
You describe yourself as an accidental teacher, so straight away that begs the question, how did you make your way into teaching?
As I confessed in the book, Catherine, I had no intention of being a teacher. I went to university. We still had to in those days, even though we got something of an allowance, we had to have holiday jobs to sort of sustain ourselves financially. I spent all of my earnings on the social life of the holiday job and didn't quite know how I was going to get through the year, and was seduced by the fact that Teachers College paid a small allowance if you went there. So it was not idealistic or deliberate.
You were in it for the money. And I can hear teachers around the country pulling their hair out. Those were the days, weren't they? For students, full stop. Very different times from the kind of financial undertakings now. Before that, though...
We didn't know how lucky we were. No.
Yeah. What was your own experience of formal education?
I have very, very clear memories of being at primary school. I grew up in the northern town of Kaikoi, which was very much a segregated town, separate schools for Māori and Pākehā, separate everything. If you went to the pictures, Māori sat downstairs and Pākehā sat upstairs. For many years, I thought that was the way of the world. And I remember being slow to learn to read, and I remember sort of waiting nervously in this line to read to the teacher, knowing that I'd get my legs smacked because I couldn't read properly. And then suddenly it all happening. So that memory is strong and pretty influential on me. And then later in secondary school, I went, heaven help me, to King's College, everything was sort of against what subsequently became my educational principles, but I was taught by wonderful, wonderful people, and so that became, ironically, a fabulous experience.
So mixed feelings about King's. Back to primary. Though, did you dodge a bullet's not a very good phrase when it comes to reading, because we know that for some children who, for whatever reason, struggle to read or don't progress at the rate people expect, it can become, unfortunately, a lifelong impact. You seem to have some kind of breakthrough moment with your reading that was not necessarily because of a system or a teacher.
Absolutely. And I think that is the case for many kids, particularly, I'm afraid, for boys who we don't seem to get it quite so quickly. That we endeavour in our system to have people learn to read before they're ready. I think that we need to wait. I think that we need to look at kids and check out that everything's okay. I mean, if they can run and jump and they can see things and their hearing's okay and they're able to concentrate on a story and they like speaking, it's probable that they're going to read. But if we say to them, you've got to do it right now, we may in fact inhibit that. People get terribly anxious about learning their kids learning to read. I don't think it matters if you learn to read when you're three or if you learn to read when you're eight. I think what does matter is what you think about reading when you're 28.
Yeah. This was a time and place still where the old rulers got pulled out and the smacks to the legs still happened, right? Again, did you learn from experiences? As a boy called Max, I recall, that you recall vividly from school? Again, this is where, whether it's the, you know, the physical discipline of the day, or whether it's the some of the attitudinal projections that kids can pick up, the impact can be severe. What was his story?
His story was that he wasn't very clever. And these were those, like when I went to school, it was a long time ago, Catherine, but when I went to school, if you weren't clever, you got punished for it. I mean, you got punished anyway because you knew you couldn't do it, and then you got punished a bit further. So we don't do that today in our schools, but what really concerns me is that for many kids, when they first go to school, they immediately know that they're not succeeding, that there's something about the environment that means that other children who've come from more privileged backgrounds, who've had more time spent on them, it's a lovely place for them. But for many, many other kids, there's the initial feeling of, hey, I'm not fitting in and I'm a bit of a failure.
What do we do about that? There's that phrase I recall, your concept of yourself as a learner, which is a typical kind of educative phrase for saying your self-belief is so important. What do we do about that when we do, you know, put kids in year classes? Didn't you get rid of year classes one year in one of your schools?
I got rid of year classes for about 6 years in one of my schools, yes.
Was it a little school, though?
No. It was an inner-city primary school. And, you know, about 300 kids. And each classroom was like a sole charge school. In other words, it had children aged 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, all learning together. And we tried to get away from the concept that chronological age had a significance about what children could do and could not do. And we tried to look at it that this child can do what this child can do, and their age is a secondary consideration. And I believe it worked. It was very hard work for teachers.
And, of course, and it was.
I like to think they bought into the idea. I don't know.
I wonder. That sounds quite radical, because there is the sort of day-to-day organisation, and there is the finite resource of teachers' energy, which is stretched every which way. But was there something about the principle of that that you can take out that can be applied in any classroom? It's the great challenge, isn't it, that we do, for practical reasons, design education to be a sort of a linear progress. It's not the way kids learn. Even individual kids learn. It's back and forward and back and forward. And if that has the byproduct of a kid feeling like they're not as bright or they're behind, what can we do? What does a good teacher do to mitigate?
Right. A good teacher, as so many people are. I mean, they're fantastic people. A good teacher finds out where a kid's at and what he or she needs next. And they disregard feelings like, or thoughts like, this is in standard two and this is what a standard two child should learn, or this is a year six and this is what a year six. And all that sort of artificial construct we put on it, with an expectation that every child of a particular age will get to a certain level, because they won't. And we simply pretend that it's happening. I think if you get a class of 8-year-old kids together, the spread of ability will be from A to Z. And if you get a class of children of all different ages, the spread of ability will still be from A to Z. So in a way, it doesn't matter.
Let's talk about your time at Teachers College. You went there because you knew there was a bit of dosh in it at some point. However, you found yourself particularly engaged by some leading lecturers. I'm curious as to what you make of how we've changed teacher education over the time. But tell me about the era you were there and how it inspired you.
I think the most inspirational person there at the time was Ranginui Walker, who came after I had been at Teachers College for, I don't know, 6 months or something. And suddenly he seemed to be this sort of breath of fresh air who was starting, unlike anybody else at the time, to talk about the needs of Māori education. There was, within the Teachers College, in quote marks, Maori stuff. We sang songs and we did stick games and we learnt some basic weaving. But in terms of addressing language and culture, let alone promoting language, he was the new voice suggesting that these things might be not just possible but desirable. So he was important, as were, I think, any of the teachers that I worked with in schools, you know, going out and seeing the practical thing and the excitement of being in a real classroom, which I think that influenced me more than any lectures did.
The range of places you've taught is fascinating. Where we begin, you've graduated, you've got your BA and your teaching diploma, you're off teaching at a school in Huapai, 30 kilometres north of Auckland. You hadn't heard of it before you got there. What were those early experiences, early formative experiences?
That was a wonderful time there. I mean, I met teachers, some of whom became lifelong friends. People gave me a lot of freedom. I mean, we're talking a long time ago. We're talking, what, about 1965. And in a way, there were fewer restraints on teachers then than there are now, which meant that people who were lazy could be lazy, and it meant that people who had ideas and thought kids' creativity were important were barely checked. And I, the principal of the school, a man called Alan Fisher, now departed, he thought I was odd, but he never wanted to stop me. And he said, look, if you want to have art with your kids in the morning instead of arithmetic like you should, you do it. If parents come complaining, don't come grizzling to me, because it's your decision. And he sort of watched me, and he was a bit surprised that the kids in my room actually learnt something, because we'd have art in the morning and because we'd go for runs and stuff like that that you weren't supposed to do. So I found then very early on that I was able to go with whatever ideas I had. And that was an amazing freedom. And sadly, it's a freedom which I don't think exists anymore.
When it's given room, what can be achieved? Tell me some of the things you would do that probably would not fit with the relentless box ticking and correct curriculum sign-offs needed today.
Right. I mean, and those sign-offs weren't actually needed then, I must add. Well, what would I do? Well, I mean, firstly, I'd have a group of kids of all different ages together and just let them interact. I think children's creativity and artwork is hugely important. I think that if you go to a preschool centre of any sort, you'll see kids grabbing paint and splattering it around, and it's satisfying some kind of need, and they're doing what they think is okay. But quite soon after they get to school, they get taught, again in quote marks, there's a right and a wrong, there's a better way, some people do it better than you do it, and all the rest of it. And we start to inhibit them from the joys that they can get from graphic art. And I, you know, in my ideal classroom, you have a great big mess and people are doing splatter painting all over the place and just being kids and exploring it. And the longer we can leave them as children rather than art students, the better.
That's why you hate colouring books and the dreaded stay within the lines, which I could never do, by the way. Not out of any artistic talent, just out of laziness, frankly. Tim Heath is our guest. His book is The Accidental Teacher, The Joys, Ambitions, Ideals, Stuff-Ups and Heartaches of Teaching Life. You write about some of the mentors who mattered to you in those early years, but you also write that marriage helped enhance your teaching. And could you elaborate?
There are no secrets left in my book.
No, there aren't many, Tim. You've lived a full and rich life. So. But it's had its heartaches too. So let's talk a little about the personal life, but also how that initial marriage and becoming a dad and all that followed. Someone grows when their emotional life grows this way. You were also to face awful grief as a young man. But how did this side of your life affect your roundedness as a teacher?
I think, firstly, my first wife, Xianyu, was an amazing person and a wonderful teacher. And of course, it was through her that I went to Samoa to teach. And teaching there, in fact, was a huge learning experience for me, because it was dropping a lot of the idealism I had, and being pragmatic and realistic about what education was like in a country less economically well endowed as New Zealand, where there was just huge pressure to get through kids through exams, otherwise they didn't go on. So that was kind of an influence. But also after that, just the practicality of being on my own with my children, I was probably heading towards becoming a secondary school teacher at that point, but because I had kids to look after, working in a primary school was just the ideal situation. So it probably caused me to focus more on primary education than I perhaps otherwise would have. And the other thing to say is that it meant that I spent a lot more time with my own children than I would have. And there was hardship about that, but it was hugely enriching for me, and it's given me a relationship with them that I might not have otherwise had. So, I didn't like the fact that my wife died compelled me into these situations, but from it, there were a lot of benefits and a lot of rethinking about teaching, yeah.
You also spent quite some time working for the Correspondence School in the 80s and then again in the early to mid-2000s. Gosh, it's such an interesting time as we look at remote learning, and I'm really interested in your wisdom on how to do it well and what sometimes you just need to accept. But could you speak a little about the Correspondence School of the day, its role, and how difficult it was both for student teacher and also perhaps for parents, and equally what some of the successes were?
Yeah. The position I had in the Correspondence School was called Regional Representative. I thought that was quite grand. And I was based in Auckland, and my job was to travel around home visiting kids doing Correspondence School work. And that took about 50% of them at that time were in the city and on the roll because there was a problem in their life. And the problem might have been that they were sick, or mentally unwell, or they'd been kicked out of school, or they were pregnant, or their family was traveling around a lot. So there were all sorts of those reasons. Then the other 50% were people in remote places. So I'd work in some pretty rough places in the city for as long as I could stand it. And then I'd go to Great Barrier Island and walk through the bush and see kids there and balance myself up a bit. And with Correspondence School work then and now, although it's hugely different now because it's so internet-based, it works for a kid if there's good support. If they're able and motivated, they're probably self-supporting. But otherwise, people need parents with them who are genuinely interested and knowledgeable about what they're doing. Parents I met, many of them tended to say, go to your room and work for the next 3 hours and don't come out. And the kid would go there and look at the flies on the wall and dream. But the parent who actually knew what the work was and that they were writing an essay about Hamlet or something and could talk about it, then that kid tended to succeed. And all this meant that children in the city who'd been thrown out of school and placed on the Correspondence School roll so it looked like they were getting an education had no show at all, apart from one or two exceptional ones. And I do relate it in the book, had tragic times when I would go and see a kid and we'd work together and they'd get it sorted out and they'd get motivated and they'd get keen and they'd say, this is great, Tim, when are you coming back? And I would say, I think in 6 months. And you could see the light die in their eyes because they just knew they couldn't sustain it.
The so-called Kiwi suspension, you call it. You saw it happening then, and it's still happening now, Tim.
Yep, it is. It is. And I know that some of these kids are impossible to have at school. And I believe that for many, for not all, but for many, perhaps being at home, away from the institution, away from the peer pressures, with good support will be the best way for them to learn. And if their family is not able to provide support because of their own educational challenges, or more particularly because they're out working trying to get some kind of living, then there has to be somebody from outside who comes and helps on a regular basis. Otherwise it dies. I one of the phrases I like using is that if you plant a seed in a desert, you've got a moral obligation to go back and water it. And we plant the seeds and just let them wither, and it's terrible.
I want to ask you the same question I asked a self-help guru yesterday, which is, what does success look like as a teacher? When have you achieved success with a student? And it's not when they've got this number of NCEA credits or whether they've got this reading level age or this or that. Ultimately, what is success as an educator with the whole range of kids who are going to come before you?
There's that wonderful moment when a kid goes from being a non-reader to a reader, and that's magic, and that's success, and it can be built on, and I greatly celebrate that. I used to send kids running around the block, and we'd time them, and you'd chart up, and you were not looking for the fastest person. You were looking for each person doing their personal best. And the joy of a kid when they'd done a personal best, you know, at running around the block, i.e. they knew they could achieve something. And perhaps that's it, that you've got learners who know they can achieve, who know they're worthwhile, who know they can do it, who know they can get there and feel okay about themselves. It's, you know, it's an overused word is empowering, but feeling that you've empowered kids is, you know, that's what kept me grinning.
You're right. My responsibility is to find a way for every child to excel at something. But many kids seem to go through school without ever receiving anything to make them feel good about themselves. Good teachers find something and reward it, make a little rainfall in every desert. You also, you talk to tomorrow's schools not because of the concept of them, talk to them in terms of critiquing them, not because of the concept of them, but because, in your view, they became mired in bureaucracy and the great sort of ideals, as so often is the case, were sacrificed, I guess, to systemic kind of bureaucracy. What's your comment now on the environment you see teachers working in and whether the system as it is really facilitates them doing their best?
When I was writing this book, I spent quite a bit of time talking to a variety of young teachers. You know, I told them that I was writing and I was interested in their views. And I felt saddened by that. I mean, they were all of them great, wonderful people and really wanting to teach and really trying. And when I talked to them at the detail of what they needed to do, my heart sank because it seemed so stifling. It seemed that they couldn't be spontaneous anymore. It seemed like, you know, that the storybook wasn't the main teaching thing, the clipboard was. It seemed they couldn't fly with winged feet anymore. And it was that some of the things they would talk about as being difficult, but it was more the whole bulk of things that they accepted, which I would have found terribly difficult to conform with and would have taken me away from what I thought was the real task.
Has it been a mistake to move away from the teachers' college model that was even, 20, 30 years ago? Has it become too much the university study and not enough the kind of more intense and specific training that used to be in the specialised colleges?
Yes, no, I don't know. I think the nature of teacher training now is fairly responsive to the curriculum demands and the assessment demands. I think those two sort of go together. I just hope that somewhere in the training system there is something which it tells teachers that they can sort of be themselves and just spend time with children, and they don't have to, achieve this goal by this particular time, and that it's a problem if they haven't. They just let it flow a little bit. I mean, I say quite often in the book that parents and people are pretty remarkably good when their children learn to speak. We celebrate every little thing that comes out. We celebrate the mistakes, the mispronounced word becomes part of the family legend. But when children learn to read and go to school, we become more rigid and seem to expect that there are very definite steps that they have to go up. And it's there aren't definite steps. It's climbing a hill, and some people go straight up and some people zigzag and some people roll back down a bit and then come up. And we've got to get away from that rigidity, I believe.
A word of wisdom for those who are homeschooling at the moment because of lockdowns, and goodness, we hope we see the back of them quite soon. But again, and even for not professional teachers, but for first teachers children have, is it a similar message? Like, yes, there's stuff that's been lost this year, but actually there are some really first principle things that are going to matter the most as you try and help your child. What are they?
Absolutely, I think you're totally right. We are going to recover from whatever the setbacks are, in all ways. But in education, I hope that parents who are home with their kids, doing the educational thing, are not too slavish about getting worksheets done and bits on paper. I think if it's a time that parents are enjoying things with their children, stories. And making pictures and going for walks and seeing if they can run faster than they did yesterday. I think that's great. And I think that I hate the feeling of a parent, a good, earnest, sincere parent saying, I must get my children to finish this bit of work. I think they need to evaluate the value evaluate the work before they get slavish about it. I don't think I want them to have conflict with their children. I mean, it's an irony. Parents and adults have to set boundaries for children, and you want your kids to behave reasonably well, but you don't want to be a sort of rigid taskmaster when what they're really wanting to do is go outside and climb a tree and talk to a blackbird.
Wonderful advice, Tim. Job well done. Thanks for your time. Tim Heath, the book is The Accidental Teacher.